So this is Anne Selby, Reel One. And if I could ask you, first of all, Anne, to tell me something about your background. This, of course, would be well before the war started, wouldn't it? Where were you born and brought up?
I was born in the town of South Shields, in what was then the County Durham, which I believe has now changed to Tyne and Wear. When I was very, very small, I was taken up by my parents to live in Cape Town, South Africa, and that is where I was actually brought up. I was brought up in a place called Plumstead, which is a suburb of Cape Town, initially. My father was what they call I suppose you'd call an expatriate worker. We didn't actually emigrate, he was actually employed by companies out in South Africa. And so we travelled home a few times.
You would have been there during apartheid, of course,
yes,
wouldn't
of course.
You?
I was there actually when it became a republic, which was quite interesting. And I remember having to learn the school song in Afrikaans, which of course was the language of the country at the time. And yes, I was there right through apartheid. And I was finally educated at Pinelands High School, which Pinelands is another suburb of Cape Town. And I achieved the equivalent of 9 O levels and 5 A levels. And I went for secretarial training, although I actually had intended to go to university, but certain things stopped me. And I went for secretarial training and worked for about 2 years for a company called Safmarine as a secretary, and then was transferred with my job to England, where I actually met my now ex-husband, and we were married, and I went up to the north of England to live, to Sunderland, more or less back to where I was born, so I'd sort of become full circle, gone full circle. And I have two children. Lee was born in Sunderland in 1971, and Peter, who was born in Sunderland in 1975. And I basically lived there, and I joined the army from there.
Why did you join the army? What was it that motivated you?
I actually was, I've had a few careers. In South Africa, when I was about 13, I started as a professional singer. And I became a professional singer and musician, and have been right from the age of 13. And I carried on in that particular role, even when I was married. The way I met my husband was because he was an aspiring musician, and I had gone for an audition as a vocalist, and that was how we met. And we'd stayed up in the northeast, and it was very difficult to get work up in the northeast. It's a terrifically depressed area. And we had travelled around Europe performing, and I think I just got very tired, and tired of the fact that there was no stability financially, and things were becoming difficult because my ex-husband didn't really want to leave music and go and get a job, so it meant that in order to provide for the kids, I had to. And so what originally happened was that I was working as a secretary. I was complaining or talking about the fact that I had very little money to clothe the boys, and it was suggested to me by somebody that I was working with that why didn't I join the Territorial Army? Because A, it would give me something to do, B, it would help me make friends. C, it would also provide me with some financial gain. And I just laughed it off at first and didn't think much of it. But then after a little while, I saw an advert in the newspaper for this. And I thought, okay, you know, I wouldn't mind giving that a go. And that was how I started off in the military. And it all sort of followed from there, basically.
How easy was it to get in?
Very easy, actually. Very easy. I don't think I had a terrible amount of trouble with my qualifications because I didn't have to have any educational standards because they were all already there. The medical I passed fairly easily. I think the biggest problem was the fact that I had two fairly youngish children, and so therefore my husband and my mother-in-law had to sign a waiver form to say that in the event of me being called to war, that they would actually look after the children. And that was basically, the form that they take you in on is called an AFB 203, which is a special enlistment form. And that was what they used in order to enlist me. And so I was enlisted into the military and as Territorial Army, and went for my training at Guildford in what was then the WRAC Centre at Quinlisford Park, which of course is no longer there. In fact, the WRAC no longer exists. They've been assimilated into the mainstream army.
So what date would that have been when you went in?
I enlisted on the 18th of February 1982. So I was actually quite long in the tooth.
This would have been about the time of the Falklands War,
exactly,
wouldn't it?
The time of the Falklands,
did that have any bearing on it?
Not a bit. I actually started the enlistment and medical procedure long before the Falklands actually became a real thing. But I do remember waiting for my recruit course and thinking, oh gosh, you know... And not that I thought for one minute that we would get called up to do that, you know, not the CA, obviously the mainstream army were the ones that actually, you know, went and did all of that, but one never knew, you know, so.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, what your expectations would have been. Did you seriously think you would be called to war when that form was signed?
Yes, I did, for the plain simple reason is I think that realistically, you have to do that. You know, it's not like a kid joining. I wasn't like a kid joining the army. I wasn't like an 18-year-old who and the army give you the usual blurb about, oh, you can go out sailing and adventure training and you can see all these places and do all these exciting things. I think to people of 18 and 19 and even a little bit older, the adventure side of the military appeals. For me, it was a very practical decision. And I was very, very much aware of the bottom line because I was 29. I think I was 29 when I joined. I hesitate to count back, it seems that long ago. But I think that when you're that age, you're more aware of the bottom line, that you're signing to die for your country. You are saying effectively, I will go out and I will die for my country. Or I will kill for my country.
This would be, you know, when you went to Guildford, of course, wouldn't it?
Yes, the initial training, what they call the recruit training. So obviously for the TA, it's very much has to be condensed. The normal training is 6 weeks for a recruit. And they had to condense it all into two. And they did actually condense the training down into two. They didn't really let up on you for a minute. It was there is a program going at the moment which is about recruits or officer cadets at Sandhurst, and the training, the fact that they never let up on day and night, is exactly what we happened to us. And I have to say that at the time there was, of course, WRAC, what were called non-combatant. Behind your badge as a WRAC, you wore a green beret, and you had a red flash behind the badge, which meant non-combatant. So therefore, they didn't actually, at Queen Elizabeth Park, take you through weapons training. Although there were rumblings of the fact that the regular female army were going to be brought in line with the male. And it seems now, looking back, that they were trying to bring it in line in order to assimilate them. So, we didn't do the weapons training, but of course we did do the exercise and we did the drill. We did all the normal components of recruit training, the making sure your uniform was in order, map reading, first aid, orienteering we did, PT of course. And basically, it was all the usual things anybody would expect a recruit to do. I mean, if you've seen the old, you know, films about the National Service, it's exactly like that. Not that I ever got sent to peel potatoes, but because they have machines to do them now. But, you know, Anna Guildford was quite interesting, obviously, because it was all female. So that was daunting. It was like being in a kind of gigantic, uniformed girls, adult girls' school, you know, complete with prefects and teachers. And, and it was interesting, to say the least.
Even the people who trained you, were they females as well?
Yes, absolutely. I believe there was only one male on the whole of the camp, and he was the warrant officer for the catering corps. He was in charge of all the kitchens. So yes, it was fairly interesting. And the other interesting thing was that there were, I think I was the oldest in the squad. So of course, I was in amongst 18 and 20-year-olds. And I had done considerable training myself. I was doing aerobics and I was going to the gym two or three times a week in any case. So I think that I held, you know, my side up fairly well in training. And many aspects of it I enjoyed. My only distress was that my ex-husband and my two kids couldn't make it down for my passing out parade, so I was kind of there on my own, and everybody else had their parents there. But then, you know, I mean, I was older, so you cope with things like that. Mm-hmm.
And your children, were there any, you know, did you have any concerns with leaving them?
No, not at the time, actually, I didn't. No. I mean, there weren't any concerns. You know, my ex-husband looked after them, and they were fine, you know. And they were very excited, you know, mummy's joined the army and all of this. And being boys, of course, it was quite important for them, really. Mm-hmm.
So having done your training, how much of your time did it take up?
The actual military itself? It wasn't intentional that it would take up a great deal of time. The intention was that it would take up 3 weekends a year and a 2-week camp. But of course, given my financial situation, the fact that my ex-husband was causing problems in that he basically was refusing to work. He was saying that we could live off the money that he got from playing music, which we couldn't. So when my HQ came back to me and said to me, look, you know, you have some good qualifications and we would like to utilise them, and we could send you away on attachments or detachments to other units, and you do work for them, and you'll get paid full army rate, and you'll be looked after, and, you know, how would you feel about that? And so, under the circumstances, I thought it was a very good idea. So I went from the idea of just doing it part-time to practically being away full-time, and not wanting to go into every single posting that I had, but I mean, obviously I had quite a few, what they call detachments. It was during that basically, you know, I was just there full time, all the time. So the idea was, well, if you're there full time, you may as well be full time. And that was basically how it happened. And, you know.
What sort of a detachments were these that you went on?
They could be almost anything. I was sent to Hereford. I was sent to the Ministry of Defence main building. Now, they all was clerical attachments. I was sent to, Basil Hill Barracks in Caution. I was sent to work there.
This must have been interesting, you know, going around different barracks. I expect you got a pretty good view of what the army was.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you? What was your impression?
At the time, I mean, I was enjoying the army. I got the impression, which has never really left me, that the British military are very well trained and very well disciplined. And I have served with other armies before. I've served with the US Army. And I've served with the foreign armies. I've served with the Danish Army and the German Army. And I find them, I find especially the compared to the US Army, we are actually almost rigidly disciplined. And I think we're better for it. That probably sounds really, really terrible, but I didn't think the US Army were very disciplined. in spite of all the shouting that they do at their troops. There is no discipline among the troops, whereas British soldiers, by and large, I think, you know, are well trained. And that was the impression that I got. Well trained and motivated. Once they were sent in to do a job, and they were sent in to do a job, and that's what they did. You know, and that impression stayed with me right up to and beyond the Gulf.
How about being a woman? You know, going round to these different detachments, you obviously were interacting with men, I imagine.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
How were you treated, you know, as a woman in uniform?
Usually what happens was that you were sent... I was WRAC attached to the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and then you were RAOC attached to a unit. So therefore, when you went to the unit, usually there was only a very small corps, if any at all, of females. Sometimes you were maybe one of only two, or maybe even just one. There were lots of rumours that went round about WRAC. A lot of the boys, I'm sure this will be interesting from a historical point of view, but a lot of the lads used to call us racks, you know. It's something you screw on top of a car. You know, rack is something you screw against a wall. WRAC, warm, round and cuddly, every soldier should have one. I personally never, ever, ever had that said to me or about me that I'm aware of. And I never, ever received anything other than courtesy and respect from the men around me. I have to say that. They never actually treated me any differently. But by the same degree, there was this expectation and this perception from the men that women were treated differently and softer, and that really, if we were getting equal pay, we should be doing the same kind of job as they are. And by the same degree, most of the WRAC actually agreed with them. It was the powers that be that made the difference between the sexes, not the people on the ground. And that was my perception. And my experience of the battle. There was no battle, not at our level. Whatever battle was taking place between, you know, sexes, it was going on way up above our heads. I've no doubt that some form of sexual discrimination actually did go on. It's just that I never actually experienced it myself.
What would your rank have been at this time, Anne, when you went in, and, you know, were you getting promoted?
Yes. I was promoted fairly rapidly, actually. I got my Lance Corporal within 18 months. And I was promoted to Corporal, but only after I'd obviously done the junior Corporal's course, which normally was done at Queen Elizabeth Park, but because I was TA at the time, it wasn't undertaken by them, actually. I went on the same Corporal's course that the men went on, of the TA unit, so I actually did the same training as the men, and that included weapons training. Because one thing I admitted to say to you was that even though women in the regular army were not taught weapons training, the moment I left recruit training and went to my TA unit, I was expected to take up weapons training, which I did. And my personal weapon was a submachine gun, and that was what I was taught to fire. But I was also taught to fire the Browning 9mm pistol and a 7.62S self-loading rifle. And then later on, of course, the present one they're using today, which they're trying to phase out because there's stuff wrong with it, is the L85, which is the SA-80.
Did you find any problems with that?
No, not at all. I have a very healthy respect for weapons. Living in South Africa as a child, my dad had guns in the house and he taught me how to use them. And I already had some knowledge, and I have a healthy respect for something that can kill you. And I think if you have a respect for it, then, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of, and I think that you use it correctly.
So what was your situation at the time when the Gulf War was sort of brewing up?
At the time it was brewing up, there was a number of things going on in my life. By this time, I had been posted away as a sergeant. Up until that point, there had been no position for me. And the kids were too young. it was becoming very obvious that in order to take promotion, I would have to actually change units, which in actual fact was what happened. And it took me away and brought me down to this part of the world, which I'd only served in on detachments in this part of the world. But I was actually sent to Blackdown Barracks in order to work there, which of course is now the Princess Royal Barracks, and that's at Deepcut. And I went there in 1987 to work, and it was while I was there I was actually promoted to Staff Sergeant. And it was in one of my little postings they gave me, I went to work for what they call the Training Development Group, who actually write the objectives for the course, the training objectives for the courses for soldiers. And myself and another staff sergeant, a lady called Mal Yates, were given a job of writing courses specifically for the TA. And we were given training, we were sent to Beaconsfield, the Army School of Education, and we were given training to do this, and that's what we were doing when the Gulf came about.
How easy or difficult was that, writing courses? Obviously you'd had a lot of experience by this time, but you know, writing courses, it's quite a responsibility, I imagine, isn't it?
It is, but they do give you full training, and it's actually quite interesting because there's a lot of analysis goes on, because the initial thing that you have to do is job analysis, task analysis, and then actually ascertaining from that what the objectives would be to train somebody up to the standard of, you know, I don't know, a corporal in a certain post. And this is not just regimental posts, this is clerical posts as well. So, of course, you have to ascertain what kind of bottom line of training they have, and, you know, supposed knowledge or presumed knowledge, which, of course, is things like get up, clean teeth, eat breakfast, you know, put clothes on. That's presumed knowledge. And then you redline it, and anything above that is something that has to be analysed into a task. And then you analyse it literally down to the nth degree until you have a set of objectives to achieve in order to qualify and actually competently and efficiently do a certain job. And then, of course, what happens after that is, from those objectives, the course to teach that person how to do all of those things is then written. And that's how it goes. So it's actually very interesting. Complicated but interesting. Mm-hmm. And because I have quite a what my son calls a nitpicking little mind, I quite enjoy getting down to that kind of, you know, hard work. It doesn't faze me at all. I think it fazed my friend Mal a lot more, you know, because she kind of got a little bit impatient with it, you know. She was a more dynamic character, or, you know, volatile, not dynamic, volatile character than I was. And of course she used to get very cross, you know, well, why do we have to do this? but during that time, unfortunately, my marriage was breaking up rather horrendously. My ex-husband, who up to this point had been very supportive, has suddenly decided that because I was away nearly all the time, and because I was only getting back about once a month, we didn't have a car, and I only could get a warrant occasionally, so I would have to save money to go back, that he got it into his head that that basically I was fooling around, when in actual fact I actually wasn't. And it was very, very difficult time for me, because he all of a sudden started to kick up a fuss about, you know, well, you know, the boys are acting up, and I need you to come away from that, and, you know, come here and do this. And I said, I can't go from a £17,000 a year job to, you know, £45 on unemployment benefit. You know, I don't think we can make that transition. And by this time, of course, I was thinking, well, and I don't see why I should.
You were still the main breadwinner, were you?
I was the main breadwinner at that stage. I mean, literally the main breadwinner. Because at that stage, my ex-husband had actually gone to college, and I was supporting him through college. And so there was a lot of stuff going on there. And, of course, my youngest son with me being away and there being no lack of, there being any lack of authority from my ex-husband's side, because he was busy washing his hands of it all, of course my younger son was going off the rails, so I was absolutely worried sick about him. I was worried about my eldest son because obviously he's mildly autistic, so he needed support. And so I was torn between everything. I was torn between trying to keep everybody's life afloat financially, and also torn between being away from my kids when they really needed me, when their father was busy ringing me up every day and saying, well, they've done this and they've done that and they've done the other one. And at the finish, he was ringing me up and accusing me of having affairs, and he would give me lists of names of people, and at the finish, this is literally just before the ghost started, he rang me up one night at the nest, and I just snapped and I said, I want a divorce. And that was the situation when the ghost was busy literally brewing up. So when they actually said to Mal and myself, you've got a choice here. You can either stay here. We've got two posts. One post is out in the Gulf. One post is UKLF down in Wilton. And I don't know what made me do it. I said, I'll do the Gulf. And I think afterwards, when I think about it, I think the reason that I did that was because I thought that if I got away, it would put space between me and the situation, and that it would give me time to think. And I did think about the possibility of being killed, and I thought, well, if I get killed, it'll sort it all out anyway. So that was the kind of mindset that I had and the kind of state of mind that I was in just before I went to the Gulf. And, and I was saying to my kids, look, I will come home if you want me to. And my son, my 15-year-old son, is saying to me, Mom, we don't want you to come back. We know that things are difficult for you with Dad and that it won't be right for you. And what we want for you to do is we want for you to just come back safely and find us somewhere to live so the three of us can be together. And that was the promise that I made to them. I will come back safely. I will find us somewhere to live.
It would seem from your son's reaction that you had kept a very close relationship with your sons.
Absolutely. When things started falling apart at the seams, they were the only, apart from my friend Mal, they were the only people I could rely upon. My youngest son was absolutely wonderful, as young as he is, and I kept them in full appraisal of everything that was going on. There was nothing between my father and me that happened that they did not know about. So, they, and at the same time, I didn't want them also to take sides. But because they were having such a hard time with their father, it was difficult. So I was getting the backlash of that. So I'm preparing for war, but I'm also worried out of my mind about them and thinking, oh my God, I'm facing this life, that I'm going to be divorced, this is completely new. It was like everything had just turned topsy-turvy, and events were just moving faster than I could actually keep up with. And when people were, I was registering on one side, the oh my God, if they use nerve gas on us, we're going to be dead. And at the same time, I was like dismissing it and thinking, okay, well, let's just go and get on with it and do it and come back. And, and it was the most peculiar kind of mindset. I was in a very strange frame of mind by that.